Good morning. Welcome to the Friedberg second quarter 2025 review podcast. I'm David Rothberg, and with me is Portfolio Manager Al Friedberg. Good morning, Al. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, David. Fine.
Good. It's always nice to talk in July. Nice summer time to
Late,
talk.
lazy July.
Lazy July, but it hasn't been a lazy quarter to talk about, and it doesn't look like a lazy quarter to think of going forward. Let's get right into it. We have many, many questions, I think, reflecting how not lazy people are about the economic outlook. There's so many, in fact, that I think I'll just put one broad one to you in the hope that many of the ones that have been put to you individually will get responded to. Let me get right to it. To me, I look at the world and I see rising long-term yields, inhibitions to trade, geopolitical risk, fraying influence of institutions that were considered the bulwarks of liberal democracy, traditional money managers wringing their hands, and yet, at the same time, credit spreads are tight, sentiment has flipped from weak to strong, the hard data is pretty good, the stock market has been roaring, retail investors are the biggest winners. How do you read these tea leaves?
I don't know.
Okay, good answer.
I don't know. I think it's quite a feat, the market is reading things that I don't seem to be reading, and they're complacent. Maybe it's part of the way it was presented originally. I guess Trump, when he wanted to raise tariffs, he, for example, tariff, which is the big issue, he threatened with a very aggressive approach, and asked, and basically the markets got scared at that point. But since then, he has been making, looks like he's making deals. We're not really sure that he is. I mean, none of these things have been really inked. But he's making deals that are lower than the original threat levels. And so the market is saying, well, it's not so bad. He's making the deals. We seem to be settling around 20%, maybe 15 to 20. Just made a deal with Japan for 15. So maybe it's not so bad. We really don't know whether it's bad or not bad. But I mean, in terms of what it was originally proposed, it is better. In that sense, it's better. Still, we have to keep in mind that it's about 10 times the level of tariffs that existed, the average rate of tariff that existed prior to Trump's moves. So it's a lot to digest, a lot to digest. And the effects are not yet very visible because a lot of the early there was a lot of buying in anticipation. There was a lot of movement in anticipation. So much of the tariff of the raises, many of the tariff raises were not put through immediately. And so it's going to take a little bit of time until we see the effect. But I believe that last month we began to see some of it. Like we had a little higher rate of inflation, and the year-over-year went to 2.7, which is significantly higher than what the Fed anyway expects the inflation rate to be. 0.3 was a monthly rate, and we were just beginning to see that flow through, seep through the system. It will take time, but in my opinion, it will be quite significant. I think by the end of the year, we are talking well over 3% annually, well over. And if we accommodate it, and we can talk about that separately, but if we accommodate it, easy money policy, very accommodating fiscal policy. If we accommodate it, I think we can have a much higher rate of inflation in 2026. So I don't think the market is yet dealing with that, right? So far, they're only dealing with the fact that things are better than they thought. they're better than he threatened with.
So are you
I
saying
think
that?
that's the only way I can explain it, right? Why it excited now. Yeah, good.
So are you saying that the effect of tariffs? I think when the market thinks of tariffs and inflation, what it's thinking is that the prices of goods that are tariffed will have to rise, and that so you have inflation, but that's a one-off. That's simply a one-off. You're seeing downstream inflationary effects of tariffs.
Tariffs are, technically speaking, tariffs are one-off, meaning usually what it means is that you get an impact on some prices, let's say not all prices, some prices. And what happens is if you don't accommodate it, I'm not talking now about strictly the classical monetary regime, if you don't accommodate it, then you get price declines in other areas, and the overall price level doesn't change a great deal. And even if it does, and even if you accommodate a little bit, you get some bump in the beginning, and then after that, it levels off. In other words, inflation being something like the rate of increase in prices, you're not going to get a rate of increase in prices that continues to accelerate. But having said that, if you accommodate it, if you allow money to grow, and at the same time the fiscal position is very stimulative, which it is, right? We're moving into a 6 to 7% deficit, and we are probably running a 6-7% deficit. So in our scheme, that means money velocity is increasing quite a bit. And money supply itself is increasing. Latest numbers are 4.5% year over year, which is much more than it was last year when it was zero. So if you accommodate it that way, then it could stay in the system and it could begin to spread to other things. So component prices will affect the final products, and then there will be like a vicious circle of some sort, where one price system will, or one price sector will affect another price sector. And then you'll have maybe shortages in some areas because shipments are not coming, because maybe exporters, foreign exporters are not sending it, or because importers are not willing to take the hit. So it will affect margins. And when it affects margins, it means that companies will try to increase their prices again. So it could have actually an effect that is not the expected one. The expected one is a one-time increase, more or less, and then a stabilization at, let's say, 2% a year. It may be that by doing what we're doing now, and especially if Trump succeeds in pushing the Fed to lower rates in this environment, then I think that you're going to see these tariff increases begin to be reflected in prices and in the rate of price increases in the next 6 months, a year, or 2 years. That's the fear to me. That's the fear to me.
So the Trump argument is that we have tariffs. Foreign governments pay, in effect, a tax. That tax goes towards balancing the fiscal deficit. And at the same time, domestic economic activity is stimulated. What's wrong with that hypothesis?
Well, the domestic economy is stimulated. Well, not quite. I mean, some sectors are stimulated, yes, but other sectors are not stimulated. Other sectors lose out. The bourbon industry in Kentucky will lose out. In Virginia, the wine industry will lose out. The thousands of people will be laid off. So some sectors will gain, other sectors will lose. It's not even. It's not even. For example, the clean industry, which had been given a lot of subsidies, is going to be losing out. Other sectors like oil maybe will be gaining. So it's not an overall complete benefit. It's partial. in some areas, and losses are offsetting that. So I don't think that that's a good argument. In total, the consumer will, and it's the consumer that's important, right? It's the consumer will lose out in total. Either he'll have to pay more for some goods, or he won't have any of the goods that he wants to buy. And that's the danger. The danger is the consumer's purchasing power shrinks, or and it's not, and things are not available to him, and that creates a drop in demand. And since consumption is 70% of GDP, a drop in consumption can bring about eventually a pretty severe recession. This is what happened, by the way, in the 70s. And when the price of oil was increased substantially, dramatically, 300% in 73, 74, it should have been only an increase in oil and everything else should have gone down. But this is not what happened. What happened was that Burns, at the head of the Federal Reserve, under pressure from Nixon, accommodated that increase by printing a lot of money. When he did that, everything went up. And when everything went up, it ate into people's incomes. We had a shrinkage in purchasing power. And then we had probably the most severe recession to that point from the time of the war. 1974, 75 was the most severe recession we have had in the United States since 1945. I believe, I'm not sure if it's 100% correct, but I think unemployment went to 10%. So, and the reason is consumers' purchasing power was diminished, was shrunk. And so they were not able to continue demand. So this is the risk. This is the risk that we're running now. We're running that risk now, that consumers' purchasing power will shrink, and they won't be able to maintain the pace of demand that we are having now.
No, and I would think also that the consumer today represents about 70% of the GDP of the
It
nation.
does.
And I would think that in the 70s it would have been less. I don't think we were in quite the consumer. I may be mistaken, but I don't think we were quite the consumer economy then that we are today. So are you suggesting then, is it, so it's your view then that we're going to have a recession?
At some point we will, but these are the kinds of things that you can't time. The conditions are going to be in place for that. The conditions are, and by the way, the consumer can sustain demand if he borrows a lot of money, right? So we can have very large increases in borrowing for some time. So it's not very easy to call exactly a turning point, but you know the conditions are there, which is, and we know already now, wages in real terms have declined in the past 3 years. Wages have declined in the past 3 years in inflation-adjusted numbers. So as they continue to decline, the conditions will be there for demand to drop. And when that finally hits the economy, it's difficult to know. It will. Probably will hit the US economy later than it will hit the rest of the world. The rest of the world will be struggling with this problem of being able to export as they used to export. And so that can have some impact on them earlier. And then the US will probably follow after that. But it's always, in the end, it's always a question of purchasing power. What is the purchasing power of the consumer? And if the purchasing power of the consumer is shrinking, then you're going to have a drop in demand. Yeah, that's inevitable.
So how do you play that? And are you positioned, if you have conditions in place for a recession and you have valuations at very high levels and you run a global macro fund, are you not tempted to find a way to be short stocks?
Right. No question about it. I mean, we're already seeing it in the market, David. The great majority of stocks, no matter what people say, and no matter what people expect and hoped, that the advance would broaden, it really hasn't broadened very much. It's still a very selective market. The last that I saw was maybe 300 stocks making new 52-week highs. That's a pittance compared to 4,000 stocks that trade on New York Stock Exchange. So it's very few stocks making new highs. That means that the majority of companies, at least investors are saying, for the majority of companies, prospects are not good. That's remarkable. I mean, we haven't seen anything like that, this kind of narrow advance. We haven't seen this kind of narrow advance in a long, long time. So the market is saying, yes, there's some trouble down the road coming. So behind the numbers that you see, or right behind the credit spread numbers, which say something else, the fact that indices are making new highs, behind these numbers, there doesn't seem to be a lot of strength. Now, you're asking me, do we not want to be short? Yes. So now that volatility has come down to maybe 15%, the VIX is down around 15% or 16%, it was 2 weeks ago. We did buy some puts. We think that the puts now are reasonably priced. We have puts for September, November, in the S&P. We are buying put options on certain industries that we think will be affected, long-term options. But in a stock market, timing is very difficult, and it's not, you cannot have so much conviction. Or you can have a lot of conviction about what's coming, but you can't have conviction in the timing. So it is, you have to move with the market. So as the market begins to turn. On the other hand, we are pretty convinced, and that's why most of our resources are there. We're pretty convinced that gold will continue to rise. And gold is being bought not because of tariffs. I mean, of course, tariffs adds to the problem of fragmentation, but not because of that, not because of interest rate policy or Powell being kicked out of the Fed. It is basically a return to central banks saying we got to keep our international reserves in something that we can trust. And it's obvious that what's happened in the last few years with the US going to such enormous deficits, that the US doesn't really care much about its fiscal probity. And so I don't see anybody, any of the major countries building up their reserves buying treasuries. So the question is, what can they buy in the meantime so that they can keep their international assets in relatively safe? And especially, safe when you're also speaking about war and potential confiscation. For instance, the confiscation of Russian reserves was a bad signal to the market. I'm not passing judgment as to whether Russia should have lost its reserves of $300 billion or $400 billion reserves. It should have, shouldn't have. But the fact is that they were confiscated. And so there's nervousness. People don't want to be in the hands of a debtor, because the debtor can do anything it wants. And so it's a very simple case. The case for gold at this moment is very simple. And we're seeing it, right? How are we seeing it? Well, for the first time now in many, many, many years, maybe 30, 40, 50 years, gold is taking now second place to the dollar in composition of international reserves. It has gone over the euro. Now we're over 20% of international reserves are in gold. Maybe, I don't know, 50% are in the US dollar. And euros is less than gold. And that trend will continue. I don't know whether it will exceed the proportion of dollars in international reserves, but it will certainly be more than 20%. So if that continues, which we think it will, prices will inevitably go higher. And so for us, it's not even a timing question. It's happening. So we're just joining the bandwagon, have to join the bandwagon, will continue to join the bandwagon until things change. How are they going to change? Well, they're going to change if we get a a responsible U.S. government. At the moment, it's completely financially irresponsible, you know, to run this kind of deficit, to try to force the Fed to lower rates against the fact that the Fed is an independent body and it has people there who can think independently and tell them what to do is not good. It's a repeat of what happened with Nixon and Burns in 1971. So that's not good. So until we get a responsible government, I don't see any other way but that gold will gain in the share of international reserves. That means continuous buying. They've been buying 1,000 tons a year for the last 3-4 years. It will continue to be so, and maybe at an accelerated pace. So it's easier to do that. That's what I'm trying to get at. It's easier for us to do that and to ride that bandwagon and to try to time the weakness of the stock market when finally the indices come down or go down. That's my point.
At the same time, you do have a kind of, I wouldn't say a gold-related take on being short stocks, but a commodity-related take on short stocks too. And I'm being very broad here. You started your business as a commodity futures trading firm, and you were trading gold very early in the early 70s. And when we were trading, when one trades commodities, supply and demand is the key issue, the key metric. And supply and demand is an issue now in private equity versus public markets. And you've thought now about how that supply and demand may affect the private equity industry. And that is a way that you could be short stocks in a way that you've been tempted and actually started to engage in being the short side of stocks.
Right. I think that's true. What's happening in the private sector, private equity, private credit sector is scandalous, actually, is becoming scandalous. It started out as being a reasonable proposition in the late 80s, 90s, when some of these big operators were able to get credit to acquire companies, to privatize companies, take them out of the public market, privatize them, improve them, tweak them in a way that they become more efficient. There was room for efficiency, and then they spit them out. They what's called they had an exit, and the exit, which means an IPO, they were able to make money, quite a bit of money. If they improved the company by 20 or 30 or 40% or 100%, it gave them large gains because they bought these companies with a lot of leverage, right? They were able to get credit for 50, 60, 70, 80% of their purchases. So by improving them a little bit and then selling them in the public market, they made a lot of money. That process was a rational process. It always starts that way. It starts rationally. It starts with something that makes sense. It started degenerating sometime after mid-2010s, like when more players came on the market. There were less opportunities available to buy companies from the public sector and fix them and sell them back. Instead, there was more companies though coming out, private companies that required funding, and that was another good thing that these companies were doing. They were funding private enterprises. But that began to lead to, that led to some, I would call it corrupt practices. Because when they did that and they started buying these private companies, there was very little transparency in the way the funding was done. Because they were successful, they were able to price these things at levels that had nothing to do with the way these things were being priced in a public market. And so they were raising very large amounts of money, and some of them became very successful, and we were starting to deal with unicorns, companies that were over $1 billion in value. Some of them deservedly so, some not. But that was stage two. Stage two was it was a good function, right? It was an idea was, let's fund these companies. They don't need to go to the public market yet. We can fund them now, and then we can take them public a little later. They can wait because there's money available. If you remember, IPOs were made for companies to raise money because they had to grow, and so they raised money through an IPO. And these credit and equity companies made it possible for new emerging companies to avoid the public market, right? They got funding, and that was amplified. The effect was amplified by the fact that the Fed practiced a very loose monetary policy, very, very loose monetary policy from 2015 on through the pandemic. You know, we went down to negative interest rates for extended period of time. So that made it very attractive. You were able to borrow money at very cheap rates or negative rates and carry these companies. It led finally to the operators buying companies or funding companies to the point that they overpaid for them. And so from the period of 1921 or 22 to now, these private equity players have financed a lot of companies, and they're sitting now with a portfolio of maybe $3 to $4 trillion of companies, but they're not able to sell them. They're not able to exit. They're not able to exit because they're expensive. They paid too much for them because the interest rate cycle made them bid aggressively for them. And when rates started going up, it's no longer, it was no longer, it, they no longer look cheap. And so now these companies are all trading well above what they can get in the public market, in the IPO market. Partners in these funds, mostly institutions, who for a long time were getting money back because the exits were great and they were making money, the exits were great. They have not been getting any exits, and so they're getting very anxious and they're saying, "Well, we need the money. How come you're not giving us any distribution?" Well, we're not giving you any distributions because we have not exited. But don't worry, we will exit. We will exit at some point. Well, it's not happening. And now there's a recent number of stories where there's a lot of secondary funds being set up where these operators create a new fund and then sell the holdings of Fund A, which have not been able, they have not been able to exit. So they sell Fund A positions to Fund B, and in the process take a fee because they sell them at a nice profit. So they take a fee. The shareholders of Fund A get some cash, they get paid out, and Fund B holders now have these companies. It's a game. It's a game. Now we have a game, right? Peter and Paul, you know, you buy you, but it's they themselves doing it, right? You sell from Peter to Paul, and then Paul will sell it to somebody else, and in the process, these companies will be taking a cut, and they will be taking fees, and but at each stage, these companies become more expensive. Understandably, when they sell it from A to B, they sell it at a profit, and so they sell it at a higher price. They mark it up at a very high price. Incidentally, the valuations are not made by independent firms. The valuations are made by the operators themselves. And that's a scandal. That's a real scandal. I think that the universities like Harvard, who are trying to raise some money, are beginning to see that what they thought was valued at $1 billion is no longer valued at that. Maybe it's worth 800 or $700 million, right? Because the valuations were not made independently. So that's a big problem coming. So let's talk about supply and demand. We have at least $4 trillion worth of stock that's going to come back in the market at some point in the next few years, maybe at much lower prices. We'll see. But the supply will begin to increase. What was the wind, with the tailwind in this bull market in stocks that we've had for the past 20 years is the fact that the amount of stocks outstanding has shrunk. The amount of stocks outstanding has shrunk. Companies have gone private, very few IPOs in relative terms. And so the shrinkage of supply has created a tailwind for the bull market. We will start to see soon the reverse process, where many of these companies, not many private companies, will come to market. And then we'll see more supply, and there will be the reverse process of what we have experienced in the past 20 years. So that's an important consideration. And it also points to the fact that these operators, private equity operators, and now private credit, a lot of it is moved to private credit because private equity is too expensive. So now many of them have moved to private credit, and they are taking the place of banks, and they're lending money at higher rates, of course, and they're taking higher risk. These operators will begin to suffer as they're no longer able to produce the exit and the flow that they did in the past. And so they won't be able to raise funds, $20 billion, $30 billion, $40 billion, that they've been raising every few months. So that will affect their earnings. So we believe that there is money to be made being short some of these big operators by private equity operators. So that's another way of playing the coming market correction, let's say.
So
So maybe I'm a little long-winded, but that's yeah.
no, but it's a fulsome description of a very complex and I want it to be flattering, but I think a very imaginative play that you've unearthed. So the portfolio from is then how much of a position does this take in your portfolio? You have gold and you have this, and what else have you got?
The portfolio has gold as a primary position. We have a little bit of cocoa because we believe it's an unusual supply demand situation where crops production for the past, and mostly in West Africa, have been very poor, and where there's little prospects of them improving. It's not a question of weather as much as incentives. Ivory Coast and Ghana have not passed on to the farmers the market prices, the world prices, and so they have very little incentive. Their costs have gone up, so we've had now 3 years, maybe 3 years of declining production and deficits. Prices went up a great deal. Then there's been a little bit of a drop in demand, and this is the big issue now, how much of a drop. Probably averaging somewhere between 6 and 8% a drop in demand. But the crops don't get better. And now we're going to get into a new main crop starting in October, and we're counting on it being quite poor. Again, we don't know about the weather, but other than the weather, we think that will be poor. And if we have a poor crop, I think the price of cocoa will continue to go higher. We'll probably make new highs. So that's our second position. We have a little smattering of home builders, which moves normally countercyclically, but it's only a small position so far. There's things going against it for the moment that are pretty significant, like affordability for buying new homes is very poor. Either interest rates have to drop 300 basis points, or home prices have to drop 25%, or incomes have to rise 40% in order to square the picture. We do have a tremendous shortage of single homes because we have not built a lot of them over the past 20 years or 15 years. But the affordability is a problem. It stands in the way for the moment. So maybe over time, we'll see some improvement. Probably the easiest way will happen is through a decline in the price of homes, which they're starting to ease. They're starting to drop. Maybe that will be the way the market will adjust. So we have a little bit of that waiting to increase the position at the right time. As I said, we own some put options on the stock market, relatively cheap with not too much of an exposure.
We have also the small short position via puts in some of these private equity operators. That's our position.
Okay.
That's our position.
Just as a tie-in, another issue with homes is the cost of homes is expensive because of financing costs, but also because of construction costs.
Yeah,
And
and now that copper is being tariffed, that's going to flow right through the construction costs.
that's going to flow right through to construction costs. On the other hand, a big part of construction costs also are soft costs related to regulations, which are slowly but steadily being dismantled. There's a YIMBY movement, the reverse of the NIMBY movement, that's originated in California, and people are recognizing the need to take away regulations, and we have a government that's starting to recognize that. So
Yeah.
this could fall into your into place.
Definitely, definitely.
Unless you have something to say about the Trump Powell dispute, and I don't know how anybody can pick that, although apparently some very successful Polymarket bettor has said that the odds of it happening are extremely low, and the Polymarket odds are very low that Powell's going to be fired. Unless you have something to add to that. I think that we'll just move on to an ending comment, if you have one, about the Canadian dollar, which, despite what I think most would have thought, has been relatively strong.
Right. I don't think I have anything intelligent to say about that dispute. And nor do I have an idea whether he will succeed in getting him out early. I believe that he has to wait 8 months to be able to replace him.
May of next year.
Right? That's
May
about
of next
8 months. So maybe he will. I don't have a particular liking or fondness for Powell. And the truth is that Powell is just as mediocre, let's say, as anyone else at the Fed. They have called it wrong for years, got totally caught in the 1921, 22 inflation. They thought it was a transitory thing. They thought it was supply chains, which it wasn't. It was their policies. It was the fact that they kept rates negative for years. So there's nobody to blame by themselves. I believe it's a very mediocre body of bankers, but the truth is, there cannot be any brilliant body of bankers. There's no such thing. I don't think that bankers can determine interest rates or the rate of increase of money. I'm a believer, as you know, I'm a monetarist, and I believe that you're probably best off just saying, keep it on a automatic control, automatic pilot. Let money grow 3% a year, 4% a year. That's it. That to me, that's the ideal. Close the central bank. I don't think that you can do anything intelligent keeping a central bank. I believe that that can only be damaging. So whether Powell stays or doesn't stay, it doesn't matter because he will probably be replaced by someone else who will be just as mediocre as he is. Now, in terms of what the market thinks, I think that if he gets kicked out, the market will be worried for a day or two, and there'll be some reaction. But the market already knows, David, the market already knows that a president can try to influence the central bank even if the law doesn't allow it. And the reason a president wants to influence the central bank is because the Treasury is borrowing phenomenal amounts of money every day. And so they want to keep their costs down, right? And as they keep their costs down, we find that they will want to interject into the process. They got to get themselves into the process and try to lower the rates. So that will be there. I think it's impossible to believe that it won't be then. It will become more of an issue in the next 20 years.
as debt gets larger and larger, as we move towards impossible rates to finance, like 150% of GDP will be impossible to finance unless you print the money. So, again, to me, it's a non-issue. I think that we all know that, first of all, Powell is mediocre. He's as mediocre as anybody else. And secondly, they're not able to, they will not be able to come to the right prescription or the right number, the right level of interest rates. And thirdly, we know that they will be overwhelmed eventually by a treasury that will impose its views and say, look, guys, I mean, they did it in 1951, 52. They had that Fed Treasury Accord where they actually fixed the rate, right? So, and the Treasury was able to borrow money at cheap rates for years. And I think they'll do the same thing eventually.
Yeah, cheap short-term rates, but long-term yields will
No,
rise.
they kept long-term rates. That's what happened in 51, 52, the accord. The Treasury Fed Accord kept the long-term rates fixed at a very low rate, and they borrowed money at those rates. They could do anything. Basically, they can do anything. They can cap those rates. They can force the Fed to keep to enter into the long-term market and just keep buying long-term bonds until you get the yields down to 3%, let's say, or 2%, and fix the rate at 2%. So, but I think the market suspects that that will happen eventually. So, whether they do it this year or 5 years from now, it's inevitable, right? It's inevitable because the amount of money that they're borrowing is enormous, enormous. And they cannot afford it. Today, the interest on the debt is larger. The interest on the debt is larger today than the defense budget. And that weakens the country a great deal.
We talk largely about the United States. We trade American in the main American securities or US dollar denominated securities, but we're headquartered in Canada and a large percentage of our client base is Canadian. And for them, the Canadian dollar is an important issue. Do you have a view on that?
Not really. I not really. I think that I mean the carry says that the Canadian dollar should weaken, right? I mean interest rates in Canada are lower than the US. Typically the interest rate differential has been the determinant of most of the move in the rates. It's that plus the terms of trade, which is the movement of commodities, right? So when commodity prices do well, Canada does better. The Canadian dollar does better. When commodity prices go down, the Canadian dollar gets weaker. Right now, commodity prices have gone nowhere. So from that side, we're not getting any indication or any support. But interest rates are lower in Canada, substantially lower in Canada. I'm not sure that the economic situation warrants it. I'm not sure that the inflation in Canada warrants it. So if I was forced to take a position or a view, I would think Canadian dollar should head lower in the next few months. But again, in an environment where the US dollar is going down against almost anything and everybody, against Taiwan and against Vietnam and against the yuan, the Chinese yuan, and against the euro, then the Canadian dollar may just join the party. But on its own, I think the Canadian dollar should get a little bit weaker. Right now, the Canadian dollar has participated in this US dollar bear market, but I don't think it's more than that. I think that's what it is, mostly sentiment based on other currencies moving against the dollar.
Al, you're up over 30% this year. We're midway through the year. On behalf of listeners, I offer you my kudos and also my wishes, of course, for an equally successful second half. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, David. Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.